Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage,
how things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. The Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission was formed in the fall of 1977 by the whaling captains of nine villages. Their purpose was to ensure the continued subsistence hunting of bowhead whales in the traditional, non-wasteful manner. They also wanted to tell the outside world the facts about the bowhead hunt and its importance culturally and nutritionally to the Eskimo people. Jake Adams of Barrow is a traditional whaling captain and the chairman of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. He answers the question, why is it necessary for the Eskimo people to take bowhead whales?
Well, from a nutritional standpoint, whale meat has a very high nutritional value, which cannot be provided by other resources.
It can't?
It could be, but the level of effort for hunting for other resources is far greater than hunting of the bowheads.
And there is a spiritual or cultural need? That's harder for people to understand, I think.
Mm-hmm. You know, culturally, the bowhead whale is very significant to the Eskimo culture. It is probably the only time that the Eskimos have a festival or celebration or taking of whales. It's been going on for a long, long time. See, the only occasion in Eskimo life that there's an occasion for such festivities.
The culture is changing, in that it's almost inevitable that things may evolve so that that particular need, cultural need, just is going to disappear in any case.
Mm-hmm. Well, the culture of the Eskimo has been changing primarily because it has been impacted by the Western civilization. But one of its very strong ties to the Eskimo culture is the bowhead whale. There's no doubt about it being the central focus of the Eskimo culture. And I think as long as the Eskimo community is able to hunt bowhead whales, that the culture will stay there.
But do you ever see a time where nobody will be hunting bowhead whales?
I don't think so. As long as the bowhead whales are there and we are not hurting the bowhead population, they'll always be there. For instance, when the commercial whalers first came up, they had some weapons, and they were first introduced to the Eskimos in the late 1800s, and we're still using the same weapons that were introduced in the late 1800s. There's been no changes in the weapons we use now.
So when they talk about exploding harpoon guns and going out in motorboats, what about that? You know that people say that, and they say they've seen Eskimo whalers hunt with the modern things.
Mm-hmm. Are they lying, or does that happen?
In terms of our culture, I suppose you can call this weapons that we have now are modern weapons compared to how they used to hunt the bowheads. But these weapons that we have were developed in mid-1850s. Some of these weapons, or the type of weapons we use, are over 100 years old. And they haven't changed any yet, except for one thing that we've been working on, the improving the effectiveness of the weapons, because a lot of times they misfire and the bomb doesn't go off and the trigger mechanism doesn't work. These are the improvements that we are working on.
Do you think that the Eskimo whalers then have had a bad bad reputation that you're fighting?
Well, certainly from the information that's gotten out to the outside world, that the Eskimo whalers has gotten a very bad reputation. And we have been in the process of educating people about how we conduct the whaling, and that we don't go around wasting the meat of the bowhead.
How do you do that? Do you invite people to come and watch, or do you go out?
I probably go out, talk to groups, and send information out to groups that request information about the bowheads.
What kind of reception do you get? Do people...
A very good reception, because they are beginning to understand what the Eskimos are about and how they conduct their subsistence whaling. There's a lot of misinformation that's gone out, since that we use cats and power boats and mm-hmm. modern explosive weapons. And this type of information has been primarily put together by certain groups that are wanting the moratorium on whaling.
What would you like to see in the future, if you could change things? What's the goal?
Well, one of our goals in what we're doing now is self-regulation by the Eskimos and subsistence whaling. This is what we're continuing to push for.
Separate from IWC, separate from the United States government?
At least separate from the International Whaling Commission. But we are willing to work with the United States government under the Marine Mammal Protection Act for management of the bowhead hunt.
Is the self-regulation working?
Yes, it is very effective last spring. All of the whalers abided by the decision and the management plan of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, although part of that decision was that the commission would go along with the quota set by the International Whaling Commission, conditioned on certain things that we would like to see. And it was very effective. The number of whales struck did not exceed those set by the International Whaling Commission.
It didn't come up to it, though, did it?
Pardon?
There were fewer.
Yeah, we took a few whales than what was set by the commission.
And was that because you stopped or because there were, you couldn't take any more?
We stopped in May, early May, last spring. He asked the whalers to come off the ice, and they did. Most of the whaling done depends very much on the ice and weather conditions. It's not just a matter of going out there and staying out there for a long period of time. You have to watch how the weather is and the ice. It's primarily it's a limiting factor in the number of whales that are caught on a year-to-year basis.
In your Eskimo Whaling Commission guidelines or rules or standards, whatever it is you have, is there any enforcement? What if somebody says, well...
Yes, we have some penalty provisions in our management plan, although up to this point we have not imposed any penalties.
I'm thinking about the future. Is that the quota in your own self-regulation may work for now, but there might be another generation, another group coming in. Is there something in there to make sure it works?
Well, I think as time goes, there'll be some changes in the management plan to suit the needs of the next generation or down the line, say, 5 years from now, because we may be entirely in a different posture than what we are in today.
For instance?
The ongoing research produces some results further down the line that we may want to change the structure of the management plan so that we can conform with what the results of the research program is. Mm-hmm. Because we don't want to drive the bowhead to extinction, because it's a very integral part of the Eskimo culture.
Jake Adams, whaling captain from Barrow and chairman of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. I'm Paula Schiller, and you've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage,
how things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information,
issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Patterns, and I'm Paula Schiller. In November 1978, Congress passed the Indian Child Welfare Act. The intent of the law was to promote the stability and security of Indian tribes and families. This was to be done in three ways. One, by preventing the unwarranted removal of Indian children from their homes. Two, by mandating recognition of the authority of tribal courts. And three, by establishing standards for the placement of Indian children in foster or adoptive homes. The law is on the books, but the regulations and standards for its implementation are yet to be determined. The Bureau of Indian Affairs was charged with the duty of holding hearings around the country to find out how the native groups want to see this law used. One hearing was held in Juneau. Carl Brimner of the Fairbanks Native Association and Mike Irwin of the Tanana Chiefs Conference testified at the hearing. Both are workers in the area of child welfare. I asked them what they would like to see incorporated into the act.
Well, there's certain points in the law right now that need to be clarified in order for the regulations to to specify things, for instance, like the tribal courts, which is one of the main focuses of the law itself. And in Alaska, we have no tribal courts. So it's very important that that something be, somehow the regulations indicate that there's a supplement to that, or somehow we devise something in place of the tribal courts.
Is that a problem with the whole act, that it's mostly geared to the lower 48?
Yeah, it's been referred to as a reservation act, meaning that, you know, it was written more to satisfy the Native Americans in the lower 48. And there's very little said or done about the Alaska situation, where, as Carl said, we don't have the tribal courts or reservations outside of Metlakatla.
And so what did you suggest, language to be incorporated, or just the opinion that something ought to be?
Well, the testimony kind of centered around two areas. One was to possibly create tribal courts, which would be a long and lengthy process and probably very expensive. And the other, which was pretty much promoted by the Native corporations themselves, was to promote the whole idea of an officer of the court, where a judge could call in someone from one of the Native corporations, such as a social worker, indicating what the family's needs are, and also naturally someone from an organization like that would be tuned into the cultural needs of that family.
What are some of the other provisions that you were working on?
Well, I think the other point that the law is really a benefit to is the whole idea that it's going to maintain the Indian culture. A lot of times, and how the laws really come about, is that Native children or Indian children have been placed in foster care in non-Native homes, and this has also occurred in cases of adoption. And this whole law allows for the control by Indians on a reservation or the Alaska Natives, which is very important, naturally.
Are the Alaska Natives included in the language of the bill, or is it not, again, a case of talking about reservations?
Well, in the definitions section of the bill, under the heading of Indian, the Alaska Native is included. But as I said, the wording throughout the bill alludes to reservations and tribal courts and these types of things. And what Carl was talking about on the preservation of the culture, within the bill, they've even set down a priority list of where a child should go, beginning with the extended family and then into someone within the tribe that's approved and licensed by the tribe on down, so that there's even that set up, just, you know, a guideline to follow.
I think, like Mike's indicated, that overall the law is really effective. It seems to really do what most people have wanted for it to happen. I think with a lot of clarification on just some technical points, that really hopefully it'll do the job. It seemed as though, too, in the testimony that I heard while I was there, that most of the agencies are within the state are more than willing to cooperate with the implementation of the law itself. State Attorney General's office was there, and State Social Service was there, and most of the Native corporations were there, and other offices. I think State Criminal Justice was there, and Alaska Federation of Natives, I believe.
But your testimony is going to Washington, I presume.
Right, that's correct.
Do you have any feel for how they're going to accept the Alaska provisions or the changes that would affect Alaska?
I think we'll get a pretty positive feedback from them. I really do. I think they're behind us, and it's all in the way that I think that they probably had Alaska Native in mind a lot of the times when they were writing things. It's just that they didn't state it, and we'd like them to state it.
Yeah, I think I agree with what Mike's saying. That's pretty much the case. The bill originated out of the lower 48, so a lot of times we were excluded. But just the whole idea of the public hearing, originally when the concept of the public hearing was put forth, Alaska wasn't included. Even in the public hearings, it looked like everyone had to go to Seattle in order to testify. And we kind of raised our voices a little bit and talked to various people, and as a result, we got one. Right,
we got
just hearings
for Alaska.
In Juneau. Right. So I think, as Mike says, I think it really will. Our thoughts and our comments will be taken into consideration.
What else, in a practical sense, does this bill do for the children?
One of the biggest benefits for the children, and it's not direct, but it'll be through, like, my office or the Child Welfare Office at FNA or at any of the other Native corporations, is that we hope to at least in some ways replace the State Division of Social Services, and if not, protect our right to be heard and to work with our Native children and families. Because right now, I hate to say it, but it's really hard working through the Division of Social Services to try and get something done for a Native child for what we want to see get done. And they're not always receptive, and hopefully this will cut out a lot of that, where we can just be able to work directly, and as Carl said earlier, about the officer of the court, where one of us would be the officer of the court, say, in a hearing, whereas now DSS always is the officer.
What are some of the things that have happened in the past? Are kids separated from families?
What usually happens is, at least I know in my case, where I service 36 rural villages, the practice is usually to take the children that need removing and bring them into the Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, Eielson, maybe even down to Anchorage, and away from the culture, away from the village setting. And it's traumatic enough when a child has to be separated from his family. He doesn't need being separated from everybody else he knows also, or at least his culture. And we hope to fix that. Well, we've been working on that with our special child welfare contract here for a long time, but it's not succeeding as much as we'd like to see it, simply because of communication breakdowns between us and other state agencies.
I think something like this, too, just as Mike indicates, we've made some attempts already with our child welfare program, but this will be kind of a long-term situation where there's a law in effect now, and this law is on the books, and everybody has to abide by it. And also, in the future, there's going to be some dollars attached to it, too, which will create some Indian centers for family counseling and, once again, to just prevent the whole breakup of the Indian family. And once that all occurs, we'll be able to maybe accomplish more of the goals that we've set out to do.
What about the licensing you mentioned for foster families? Is that are there any special guidelines that would relate to Alaska in those procedures?
No. Every state has their own regulations and procedures for licensing foster homes and adoptive homes. And presently, Tenant on Chiefs is operating under the state statutes. And we found that a lot of times in the villages, you just can't bring a village home up to those standards. And they've been pretty lenient with this. Whenever I've asked for a waiver, they've been pretty good about doing it for me. But this, one of the things mentioned, it wasn't in my particular testimony, but in a lot of the testimony, it was suggested that perhaps the contractor, say the Native contractor, could establish their own sets of regulations, procedures for licensing a foster home, more reflective of the culture that, you know, the Indian culture, the Native culture.
Even though you're giving your support, are there any problems you have with the bill at all? Is there something that maybe isn't quite right with it that you haven't mentioned already?
I know there was one area that several of us testified on was an area which the law specified an expert witness in cases of, how did they put it, psychological or physical damage to the child. And I think, here again, if we go back to expert witness and we expect some psychiatrist or psychologist or, in some cases, even a MSW social worker to become that expert witness, we're not really doing what the intent of the bill is, or the intent of the law, excuse me, in that a lot of times those people are not familiar with the Native culture, and as a result, will not be aware of some of the needs, the special needs that that child may have. And we've asked that expert witness be a little broader in term, and that they include someone who will have some expertise in the culture, be it someone from the village council, perhaps, of that particular area, or at least a social worker working in a Native corporation.
Carl Bimner of the Fairbanks Native Association and Mike Irwin of the Tananaw Chiefs Conference talking about their testimony on the Indian Child Welfare Act. For Chinook Patterns, I'm Paula Schiller, and Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.